Today's show for December 31st, the final day of the year. As is my habit, I'm not doing anything particularly special for today's show. But the first half will be serious, and the second half will lighten it up. One of the stories that seem to be tops in the alternative press is the situation in Gaza with the Israeli invasion or proposed invasion of Gaza. I don't have any stories on that. There's just too much going on there. And also a man named Connell, who was the internet specialist for Karl Rove, and he died mysteriously in a plane crash 2 days before he was due to testify. Surprise, surprise. No stories on that, but I'll probably get to that next week. Okay, regular listeners won't be surprised by this article, but since it comes not from the liberal or the radical press, but from U.S. Army War College, perhaps we should give it a listen. It's titled, Report, Military May Have to Quell Domestic Violence from Economic Collapse. It was originally printed in rawstory.com and republished in opednews.com. A new report from the U.S. Army War College warns that deepening economic strife in the U.S. could lead to civil unrest and violence that would require military intervention. Nathan Frieder, a 20-year Army veteran and visiting professor at the college, writes, quote, widespread civil violence inside the United States would force the defense establishment to reorient priorities in extremes to defend basic domestic order and human security. A copy of the 44-page report can be downloaded off of the website, which I'll have on my website. Frieder notes that his report expresses only his own views and does not represent U.S. policy, but it's certain that his recommendations have been read by at least some Defense Department officials. He warns that potential causes for such civil unrest could include another terrorist attack, quote, unforeseen economic collapse, close quote, loss of functioning political and legal order, purposeful domestic resistance or insurgency, and we know what that means. It means any protest that the government doesn't like. Pervasive public health emergencies and catastrophic natural and human disasters. The situation could deteriorate to the point where military intervention was required, he argues. Under these conditions and at their most violent extreme, he concludes, civilian authorities, on advice of the defense establishment, would need to rapidly determine the parameters defining the legitimate use of military force inside the United States. So, obviously, they're preparing that if there is civil unrest due to any cause whatsoever, the military will be prepared to move in. Posse comitatus be damned. Just in case you're considering donating to MoveOn.org, you might want to hear this first. It's titled, Move On's Shocking Retreat from the Battlefield. It's from the fifth column by P.M. Carpenter. I'm not a joiner. I'd like to think that's because of an Emersonian rather than Groucho Marxian impulse. It's true I'd want nothing to do with any group that would have me as a member. But on the other hand, groups, by definition, have a disagreeable tendency towards groupthink. The results of their herd mentality are also horrifically predictable, usually. But on occasion they do surprise, and that's precisely what MoveOn.org's membership did last week. As the Politico reports, it was then that the group's members chose their top four priorities for the organization, winnowed down from a top 10 list, culled from 50,000 suggestions. And here's what they chose. 1. Universal health care, economic recovery and job creation, building a green economy, stopping climate change, and end the war in Iraq. All perfectly sensible targets, for sure. It is, however, that which failed to make the final cut that surprised me to the point of shock, holding the Bush administration accountable. Let me back up just a bit. I was shocked for only the briefest of time, for I quickly remembered that this was a group making these selections. Collectively arrived at, common denominators of idealistic baubles, bangles, and beads. And what was so shiny yesterday is already a tarnished toy, accountability. MoveOn's executive director, Eli Pariser, framed the Democratic outcome in this way. He says that this happy alignment with Barack Obama's agenda and fortuitous absence of conflict with same comes in part because the people he's listening to and the people we're listening to are the same people. The Politico framed it in another way. The Politico is some sort of a news organization. I'm not sure its source. The Political framed it in another way. The final four priorities may be a sign that MoveOn's members want to move ahead and that they're willing to make some ideological sacrifices in exchange for real progress. Okay, somebody's fudging here, big time. Groupthink, the institutional disease which for years MoveOn.org spent considerable resources properly assailing, is now a democratic virtue, according to, yep, MoveOn. And according to the Politico, sweeping aside or under the rug years of immensely impeachable, extraordinarily indictable high crimes and misdemeanors is little more than an ideological sacrifice. Just who's kidding who here? These are crimes we're talking about. War crimes, constitutional crimes, crimes against the people, crimes against the world, crimes simply put against humanity. And it's a trifle more than an ideological sacrifice or democratic virtue to now neglect the prosecution of those crimes. Indeed, that would be an unpardonable crime in itself. I'm not suggesting we pursue some animalistic joy of revenge. In fact, revenge has nothing to do with it. This is national self-preservation I'm talking about. For if we permit the Bush administration's darkest luminaries to walk away, legally unscathed, we're inviting more of the same. And that more will return to haunt us in exponential spades. Roughly a year and a half ago, Bill Moyers invited the national liberal, the nation's liberal John Nichols, and conservative attorney Bruce Fein onto his show. The result was perhaps the most riveting and critically important broadcast in the history of public television, said Nichols. On January 20, 2009, if George Bush and Dick Cheney are not appropriately held to account, this administration will hand off an executive toolbox with more powers than any president has ever had, more powers than the founders could have imagined. And that box may be handed to Hillary Clinton, or it may be handed to Mitt Romney or Barack Obama or someone else. But whoever gets it, one of the things we know about power is that people don't give away the tools. They don't give them up. The only way we take tools out of that box is if we sanction George Bush and Dick Cheney now and say the next president cannot govern as these men have. We ought to be discussing impeachment, not because of George Bush and Dick Cheney, but because we're establishing a presidency that does not respect the rule of law. And people, Americans, are rightly frightened by that. Their fear is the fear of the founders, said Fein in rebuttal. Bush has claimed the authority to tell Congress they don't have any rights to know what he's doing with relation to spying on American citizens, using that information in any way that he wants, in contradiction to a federal statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Excuse me, this is not a rebuttal. Client Fein is agreeing. He's claimed authority to say he can kidnap people, throw them into dungeons abroad, dump them on out into Siberia without any political or legal accountability. These are standards that are totally anathema to a democratic society devoted to the rule of law. The Founding Fathers expected an executive to try to overreach and expected the executive would be hampered and curtailed by the legislative branch. Yet Congress has basically renounced, walked away from the responsibility to oversee and check. Now, when you abandon that process, you abandon the ship of state, basically, and it's going to capsize. None of that was vengeful or ideological. It was rather profoundly pragmatic, while faithfully constitutional and forward-looking. George W. Bush et al. Paved the road to our destruction. If they're not held accountable, it is we who will have summoned our own demise. That was P.M. Carpenter writing in the Fifth Columnist. Next article is by Joshua Holland, writing in Alternet.com. Was the credit crunch a myth used to sell a trillion-dollar scam? There's something approaching a consensus that the Paulson Plan, also known as the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, was a boondoggle of an intervention that's flailed from one approach to the next with little oversight and less effect on the financial meltdown. But perhaps even more troubling than the ad hoc nature of its implementation is the suspicion that has recently emerged that TARP, hundreds of billions of dollars worth so far, was sold to Congress and the public based on a big lie. President George W. Bush, fabulist in charge, articulated the rationale for the program in that trademark way of his, as if addressing a nation of slow-witted 12-year-olds, last September 24th. Major financial institutions have teetered on the edge of collapse, and begun holding on to their money and lending dried up. And the gears of the American financial system began grinding to a halt. Bush said that if Congress didn't give Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson the $1 trillion, give or take a bit, for which he was asking, the results would be disastrous. Even if you have a good credit history, it would be difficult for you to get the loans you need to buy a car or send your children to college. And ultimately, our country could experience a long and painful recession, said King George. For the most part, the press has continued to echo Bush's central assertion that there's a credit crunch, preventing even qualified borrowers, that's the key point, from getting loans, and it's now part of the conventional wisdom. But a number of economists are questioning the factual basis of the credit crunch narrative. Columnist David Sirota recently looked at those claims and concluded that Americans had been punked, that the major claims about a credit crisis that justified Congress cutting a $1 trillion blank check to Wall Street were demonstrably false, and the threat of a systemic banking crash was used by the Bush administration to overcome popular resistance to the bailout. It's a reasonable conclusion. This is an administration that used the threat of thousands of al-Qaeda sleeper cells in the United States to sell Congress on the Patriot Act, the specter of mushroom clouds rising over American cities to push through the Iraq War resolution, and the supposedly imminent crash of the Social Security system to push for privatizing Americans' retirement savings. But the question comes down to what they knew and when did they know it. The analysis that suggests the whole credit crunch narrative is false are based on data that lagged behind the numbers that policymakers had available in real time back in September. So the question, probably unanswerable at this point, comes down to whether or not they looked at the situation and in good faith believed that pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into the banking system would contain the damage and save an economy teetering on the brink of collapse. What else could be happening? Of course, no one disputes the fact that as the economy has tanked, the number of new loans being issued to American families and businesses has plummeted. But is it because credit has dried up for qualified borrowers? Economist Dean Baker doesn't think so. He explains the situation in simple terms. The media, he argues, are blaming the economic collapse on a credit crunch instead of the more obvious problem that consumers just lost $6 trillion of housing wealth and another $8 trillion of stock wealth. It's a common-sense argument. Much of the economic growth of the Bush era existed on paper only, built on the rise of a massive bubble in real estate values, rather than growth in productive industries. When all that ephemeral wealth vaporized, and with the economy shedding jobs like a dog with dermatitis, consumers stopped buying, and businesses, anticipating a long slowdown, stopped seeking the loans that they might have otherwise tapped to expand their operations. Whether good borrowers can't get credit from banks because the latter are hoarding cash, or lending is stopped because of a drop-off in demand for new loans, is not some wonky academic debate. It's of crucial significance. Because if lending to qualified parties has truly frozen, then even if the specific implementation of the Paulson plan was deeply flawed, its broad approach, recapitalizing banks in various ways, buying up some of their crappy paper, and guaranteeing some of their transactions, is fundamentally sound. If, on the other hand, the primary problem is that the people are broke and maxed out on debt, and firms aren't looking for money to expand, then the kind of massive stimulus package being considered by the Obama transition team and congressional Democrats, largely designed to stimulate demand from the bottom up, with public works projects, tax cuts for working families, aid to tapped-out state and municipal governments, and new money for unemployment and food stamps, is obviously the best approach to take. Broadly speaking, these are the parameters of the debate in Washington, and that means that properly diagnosing the underlying problem is crucially important. Is the credit crunch a big lie? There's plenty of evidence that Baker's right. He points out that even though mortgage rates have plummeted, the number of applications for new loans has dropped to very low levels, and argues it's the most glaring refutation of the claim that people are unable to get credit. If credit-worthy applicants were being denied loans by banks, unable or unwilling to lend, Baker explains, then the ratio of mortgage applications to home sales should be soaring as qualified home buyers apply to multiple banks for loan. Since there's no such notable increase in this ratio, access to credit is obviously not an issue. Again, this is common sense. Consumer spending drives about 70% of the U.S. economy, and in recent years, much of that spending was financed by people taking chunks of home equity out of their properties. People might have been eating in fancy restaurants, but they were essentially eating their living rooms to do so. Then the American people don't have the appetite that the American people don't have the appetite to go deeper into debt than they already are in order to make new purchases is hard to dispute. In November, consumer prices across the board fell at a record rate for the second month in a row. And even with mortgage rates plummeting, so many homeowners are underwater, owing more on their homes than they're worth, that they're unable to refinance because the equity just isn't there. Paul Schuster, a vice president at Marketplace Home Mortgage, told the St. Paul Pioneer Press, "What I'm really concerned about is the job picture. If people don't feel good about their jobs, rates aren't going to matter." The National Federal of Independent Businesses November survey of small business owners found no evidence of a credit crunch to date, concluding that if credit is going untapped, it's largely because company operators are not choosing to pursue the credit. It's not that companies can't get the extra money, so they don't want or need it because of the broader slowdown in economic activity. Okay, this is just more of the same. We'll go to the final paragraph. It's also the case that single-cause explanations for complex crises usually fail to hit the mark. Banks, having fueled the housing bubble and similar bubbles before that with the creation of ever shadier exotic securities, are probably erring on the side of caution in writing new loans. They're looking at their balance sheets as quarterly reports approach, and the number of foreign investment dollars coming into the U.S. has declined, meaning that some qualified firms may indeed have trouble raising cash in the near future. Dean Baker, while arguing that the main story is that people don't have money and therefore want to spend, acknowledged that some banks are undoubtedly anticipating more write-offs from other loans going bad, so they hang on to their capital now rather than make new loans. And, as Sirota notes, some of the institutions that are relatively healthy are reportedly holding cash in anticipation of picking up weaker banks on the cheap. But one thing is clear. The economic crisis may have woken up Washington's political class when it hit the banks, but it remains a product of long-term imbalances in the economy. And the idea that's primarily a pathology of the banking system in isolation is a misdiagnosis that, if uncorrected, can only result in a longer, deeper, and more painful recession than might otherwise be the case. What the article does not state is that the trillion-dollar bailout of the bankers benefits the same people that caused it in the first place and does nothing for the common man. But you guys knew that. Related article, Wall Street Sets the Stage for the Big Heist. It's by Andrew Hughes, writing in opednews.com. One could not help but notice that constant emphasis during and since the Obama campaign are on climate change and green energy programs. The world has a real need to develop more oil-independent energy sources and halt the wholesale rape of Mother Earth. However, hearing these pleas from Washington to London, from the highest offices in the land, only demand more thorough investigation. When one remembers that these same high offices have been responsible for the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, and the destruction of the economy, taking anything at face value is a precarious enterprise. I think there was a phone call when I started reading, so be patient, and I'll get to you after this article. As in all schemes brought to life by government office, the first question that begs to be asked is, que bono, who benefits? When a carbon tax or a carbon cap and share program is announced, the one thing that can be assumed is that it will be designed to make money for those who usually make the money all along. To believe that Washington or London have developed a more altruistic nature and suddenly want to save the world is to deny decades of political and economic history. The road to discovering the real truth behind the plan is to follow the money, the players, and the science. On the change.gov website, there was a news release about the bipartisan Governor's Global Climate Summit in Los Angeles, California. Among the attendees were Governors Rod Blagojevich of Illinois and Arnold Schwarzenegger of California. The Terminator and the Auctioneer were playing their part in the birthing of the new impending disaster, just as much as Condi Rice, Bush, and Rumsfeld played their part in creating the mushroom cloud scenario with Iraq. Mr. Obama had prepared a speech to address the conference via video. From the speech, "Few challenges face America and the world are more urgent than combating climate change. The science is beyond dispute and the facts are clear. Sea levels are rising, coastlines are shrinking. We're seeing record drought, spreading famine, and storms that are growing stronger with each passing hurricane season. We're presented with a doomsday scenario that seems to pale into insignificance compared to the current financial Armageddon, which is approaching with ever greater speed. Action must be taken, or otherwise we will be paddling canoes to the food shelter next year." The statement is meant to scare the population into accepting more control over their lives by presenting themselves as the saviors. The statement is actually a motley collection of disproved assumptions. The consensus on global warming is seriously fragmented, and former IPCC scientists are coming out of the organization in droves. They attest to political manipulation, gross misrepresentation of scientific studies to comply with the official line, and a heretic hunt for the unbelievers reminiscent of the Dark Ages. Climate skeptics have been likened to flat earthers. The irony in this is that the Earth was found to be round by using scientific deduction, whereas global warming has been concocted through the selective manipulation and outright falsification of scientific data. The recent global warming conference in Poznan, Poland, was visited by 650 eminent scientific minds to refute the very basis of the global warming debate. Though Al Gore had said previously that the facts are in and the debate is over, it would seem he has a long way to go before he convinces everybody. The statements of these scientists have been compiled in a minority report on the U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. Here are some quotes. "Anyone who claims that the debate is over and the conclusions are firm has a fundamentally unscientific approach to one of the most momentous issues of our time." This was solar physicist Dr. Paul Brekke, senior advisor to the Norwegian Space Center in Oslo. Brekke has published more than 40 peer-reviewed scientific articles on the sun and solar interaction with the Earth. "The models and forecasts of the UNIPCC are incorrect because they are only based on mathematical models and presented results at scenarios that do not include, for example, solar activity." This was Victor Manuel Velasco Herrera, a researcher at the Institute of Geophysics of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. "The Kyoto theorists have put the cart before the horse. It is global warming that triggers higher levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, not the other way around. A large number of critical documents submitted at the 1995 UN conference in Madrid vanished without a trace. As a result, the discussion was one-sided and heavily biased, and the UN declared global warming to be a scientific fact." This was Andrei Kapitsa, a Russian geographer and Antarctic ice core researcher. "For how many years must the planet cool before we begin to understand that the planet is not warming? For how many years must cooling go on?" This was geologist Dr. David Gee, the chairman of the Scientific Committee of the 2008 International Geological Congress, who has authored 130-plus peer-reviewed papers and is currently at Uppsala University in Sweden. "Creating an ideology pegged to carbon dioxide is a dangerous nonsense. The present alarm on climate change is an instrument on social control, a pretext for major businesses and political battle. It becomes an ideology which is concerning." This is environmental scientist Professor Delgado Domingo of Portugal, the founder of the Numerological Weather Forecast Group. He has more than 150 published articles. Okay, that's enough quotes. Look at the report linked above to see all the observation made on the current debate, which Al seems to think has been settled. A group of these scientists also sent a letter, dated July of this year, to the UN Secretary General to ask you to redress the lack of scientific integrity of the UN's climate change panel, and to stop making reactionary and futile climate change recommendations that hold back the developing world. As an addendum to the letter, data is also included that disproves the assertions of the IPCC and exposes grave manipulation and outright fraud. Yes, Al, the facts are in, and the debate is far from over. If we assume that global warming is indeed a political potpourri of half-truths and lies, then we have to see why so much trouble has gone to its creation. One simple answer: money. When we look at the campaign donors to Obama's campaign, you could be forgiven your inevitable cynicism when we see the list contains the biggest players on Wall Street. J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Morgan Stanley have already benefited enormously from the TARP. J.P. Morgan Chase used some of it to buy Washington Mutual for $1.9 billion and Bear Stearns for $1.1 billion. J.P. Morgan, along with Goldman Sachs, control the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, which is responsible for reporting on the derivatives market. Citigroup, after receiving billions in taxpayer money to try and get them out of a hole, have been using the money to create new derivatives that will be overseen by the DTCC. The interdependence between these Wall Street giants and their revolving door with government power has been amply demonstrated by the policies of Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson. While there was unlimited money for the banking giants, the taxpayer was ignored and robbed. These are the same players who financed the new administration and packed the ranks of Obama's transition team with its alakites. Remember, Obama voted without hesitation for the bailout bill and encouraged his fellow Democrats to do likewise. So what does Obama owe his benefactors? By ignoring the real science and perpetrating Al Gore's fraudulent disaster scenario, Obama has taken up the torch and will carry it high for the profit of those who bankrolled him into office. It will come as no surprise that Goldman Sachs has bought into the carbon offsets business. That is exactly what it has become, a huge business opportunity that will bring enormous potential for profit. The article sums it up quite succinctly, that banks buying into the offsets business could benefit if a federal carbon trading system took hold in the United States. President-elect Barack Obama favors such a system, but some experts think that the financial crises will cause Congress to delay passing a cap-and-trade bill. So now we can see the dots connecting between a project which started as a Save the Planet campaign to a lucrative business venture. Obama's insistence that global warming is a top priority only goes to show just how quickly he intends to make good on his deal with Wall Street. Even Al Gore himself has his own investment in the carbon trading scam through his firm, Generation Investment Management. Everybody except the general public, whose welfare we're told is such a top priority, is getting on the latest investment gravy train. They tapped out the taxpayers by bleeding them until they were dry, so now it's time for a new investment opportunity that will cause untold hardship for the poor, impose a tax burden on industries trying to get to their feet after being knocked flat, and inject another poison arrow into the real economy. That was Andrew Hughes writing in opednews.com, and we have a caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hey, Chama, this is Carl. Actually, I don't have a question. I just wanted to say thank you for a really great year of independent journalism.
Oh, thank you.
And I emphasize the word journalism. And have a happy new year.
Terrific. Thanks very much.
Uh-huh. Bye.
You as well. Have a great new year.
All right.
Okay. 12:35 in the p.m. You're listening to KVMR FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. Let's see. Okay, one more serious, and then we'll get some fun. The News Titans. Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, and other top Bush officials could soon face legal jeopardy. It's by Jonathan Templeman, writing in Newsweek. It's a Newsweek web exclusive, which means it was in Newsweek. The United States, like many countries, has a bad habit of committing wartime excesses and an even worse record of accounting for them afterward. But a remarkable string of recent events suggests that that may be finally changing, and that top Bush administration officials could soon face legal jeopardy for prisoners' abuse committed under their watch in the War on Terror. In early December, in a highly unusual move, a federal court in New York agreed to rehear a lawsuit against former Attorney General John Ashcroft, brought by a Canadian system, Maher Arar. Arar was a victim of the administration's extraordinary rendition program. He was seized by U.S. officials in 2002 while in transit through Kennedy Airport, deported to Syria where he was tortured. Then on December 15th, the Supreme Court revived a lawsuit against Donald Rumsfeld by four Guantanamo detainees alleging abuse there. A reminder that the court, unlike the White House, will extend constitutional protections to foreigners at Gitmo. Finally, in the same week, the Senate Armed Services Committee, led by Carl Levine and John McCain, released a blistering report specifically blaming key administration figures for prisoner mistreatment and interrogation techniques that broke the law. The bipartisan report reads like a brief for the prosecution, calling, for example, Rumsfeld's behavior a direct cause of abuse. Analysts say it gives a green light to prosecutors and supplies them with political cover and factual ammunition. Administration officials, with a few exceptions, deny wrongdoing. Vice President Dick Cheney says there was nothing improper with U.S. interrogation techniques. "We don't do torture," he repeated in an ABC interview on December 15th. The government blamed the worst abuses, such as those at Abu Ghraib, on a few bad apples. High-level charges, if they come, would be the first in U.S. history. "Traditionally, we've caught some poor bastard down low and not gone off the chain," said Bert Newborn, a constitutional expert and Supreme Court lawyer at New York University. Prosecutions may well be forestalled if Bush issues a blanket pardon in his final days, as Newborn and many other experts now expect. Some see Cheney's recent defiant-sounding admission of his own role in approving waterboarding as an attempt to force Bush's hand. Constitutionally, Bush could pardon everyone involved in formulating and executing the administration's interrogation techniques without providing specifics or naming names, and the pardon could apply to himself. Such a step, however, would seem like an admission of guilt and thus be politically awkward. I'll have to interrupt here. Since when is Bush bothered with anything that's politically awkward? Expect the pardon. Back to the article. Even if Bush takes it, civil suits for monetary damages could still proceed. Such cases, though hard to win, are proliferating. Yet most legal scholars argue that a civil suit would not be the best approach here. Newborn calls it an excessively lawyer-centric strategy and says judges are extremely reluctant to award damages in such cases. Conservative legal experts like David Rifkin, who served in the Reagan and first Bush administrations, argue that no accounting is necessary, since the worst interrogation techniques, like waterboarding, have already been abandoned and Obama is expected to make further changes. My comment, I'm not sure they've been abandoned, and we can't trust Obama to make any changes at all. Back to the article. A growing group of advocates are now instead calling for a South African-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Kenneth Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch, says that although we know what went on, knowledge and a change in practices are not sufficient. There must be acknowledgement and repudiation as well. He favors the creation of a nonpartisan commission of inquiry with a professional staff and subpoena power, calling it the only way to definitely repudiate this ugly chapter in American history. But for those interested in tougher sanctions, one other possibility looms. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and author of The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld, points out that over 20 countries now have universal jurisdiction laws that would allow them to indict U.S. officials for torture if America doesn't do it itself. A few such cases were attempted in recent years but were dropped, reportedly under U.S. pressure. Now the Obama administration may be less likely to stand in their way. This doesn't mean it will extradite Cheney and company to stand trial abroad, but at the very least, the threat of such suits could soon force Bush aides to think twice before buying plane tickets. "The world is getting smaller for these guys," says Ratner, "and they'll have to check with their lawyers very carefully before they travel. Jail time it isn't, but it may be some justice nonetheless." My addendum to that is that Henry Kissinger has avoided traveling to some countries for exactly that reason. Okay, let's get a little bit lighter. I read an article last week concerning some of the things that people have run into when they've tried to board airplanes. I'm going to continue with that. There's one holiday ritual we all know and hate. It's that yearly trip to the airport where the friendly security man awaits with his X-ray machine, his metal detector, and possibly a well-lubed rubber glove. While none of us want to spend the holidays involved in a terrorist incident, you have to admit that sometimes security gets a little out of hand. So I'll continue with just a few more of the horror stories. You can only feed your kids so much. Transportation Security Administration, as you might have heard, banned liquids for a while. But what about the children? Well, the TSA, of course, allows amounts of baby food reasonable for the duration of the itinerary. Reasonable being the key word. Can you see what's about to go wrong here? Two people were traveling with a 10-month-old from Chicago to Manchester, New Hampshire. This was in February, and being reasonably bright people, they assumed there might be a few delays flying between the two places famous for snow in the middle of winter. So they brought along 6 jars or so of Gerber's and 20 ounces of formula, which a TSA employee told them was too much. The supervisor on shift agreed. They were told they'd need a doctor's note to bring that much food. Oh, by the way, both of the parents were doctors. To make things worse, a traveler named somebody or other saw her toddler's sippy cup get confiscated because it had water in it. So maybe her son was on the watch list. Or not, since Monica, the woman involved, is a former Secret Service agent. The TSA stops a dangerous terrorist T-shirt. Ray Gerard was just looking to get on his flight. The IROC project director for Global Exchange is a pretty busy guy, after all. And being a political guy and all that, he was wearing a T-shirt in Arabic and English saying, "We will not be silent." These are the situations irony was invented for. The man was pulled out of line and questioned because of the T-shirt had Arabic on it, which he was told was like wearing a T-shirt saying, "I'm about to rob a bank." They wouldn't let him fly unless he covered the Arabic script with another T-shirt, which they figured would offset the magical plane-destroying powers of the silkscreen letters. And to make things worse, there's Dr. Ahmed Farouk, a Canadian national who got booted off an airplane for performing his evening prayers. To the TSA's credit, that was the flight crew that made the call, and the TSA agents at the airport realized it was retarded, but didn't realize it in time to get him back on the flight, which took off without him. Of course, the airline didn't feel bad enough to actually pay for his return flight the next day or the cost of the hotel he stayed in. At least the least they could have done was send him home with a free box of confiscated knives or a T-shirt. Okay. In honor of stupid people. In case you need further proof that the human race is doomed through stupidity, here's some actual label instructions on consumer goods. On a Sears hair dryer, do not use while sleeping. On a bag of Fritos, you could be a winner, no purchase necessary. Details inside. On a bar of Dial soap, directions, use like regular soap. On some Swanson frozen dinners, serving suggestion, defrost. Keep in mind, that's only just a suggestion. On Tesco's tiramisu dessert, it's printed on the bottom, do not turn upside down. On Marks and Spencer's bread pudding, product will be hot after heating. On packaging for a rowended iron, do not iron clothes while they are on your body. On Nitol sleep aid, warning, may cause drowsiness. On most brands of Christmas lights, for indoor or outdoor use only. On a Japanese food processor, not to be used for the other use. On Stainsbury's peanuts, warnings, contains nuts. On an American Airlines packet of nuts, instructions, open packet, eat nuts. On a children's Superman costume, wearing of this garment does not enable you to fly. On a Swedish chainsaw, do not attempt to stop chain with your hands or genitals. A shepherd was herding his flock in a remote pasture when suddenly a brand new BMW advanced out of the dust cloud towards him. The driver, a young man in Brioni suit, Gucci shoes, Ray-Ban sunglasses, and YSL tie, leans out the window and asks the shepherd, "If I tell you exactly how many sheep you have in your flock, will you give me one?" The shepherd looks at the man, obviously a yuppie, then looks at his peacefully grazing flock and calmly answers, "Sure, why not?" The yuppie parks his car, whips out his Dell notebook computer, connects it to his AT&T cell phone, surfs to a NASA page on the internet, where he calls up a GSP satellite navigation system to get an exact fix on his location, which he then feeds to another NASA satellite that scans the area in an ultra-high-resolution photo. Then he does a whole bunch of other technical stuff and finally prints out a report and turns to the shepherd and says, "You have exactly 1,586 sheep." "That's right. Well, I guess you can take one of my sheep," says the shepherd. He watches the young man select one of the animals and looks on with amusement as the young man stuffs it into the trunk of his car. Then the shepherd says to the young man, "Hey, if I can tell you exactly what your business is, will you give me back my sheep?" The young man thinks about it a second and says, "Okay, why not?" "You're a consultant," says the sheep. "Wow, that's correct," says the yuppie. "How did you guess that?" "No guessing required," answers the shepherd. "You showed up here even though nobody called you. You want to get paid for an answer I already knew, to a question I never asked, and you don't know a damn thing about my business. Now give me back my dog." Okay, 2008's Funniest Political Moments. It's by Daniel Kurtzman. I think it was originally in the New York Times, but I got it off of opednews.com. In a year when everyone was looking for a bailout, politicians did more for political comedy than any other industry. We had governors gone rogue, reverends gone wild, shoe throwers, imaginary snipers, and of course everyone's favorite mavericky Prada-wearing hockey mom. As a salute to those who made this the funniest year since, well, last year, here's a look back at 2008's most memorable feats and foibles. Worst photo op: Sarah Palin's turkey pardoning fiasco, also known as Waddlegate, in which she pardoned a turkey at a farm in Wasilla and then gave an interview while other turkeys were being shoved into a cone of death and slaughtered just behind her. As David Letterman joked, she can see Russia, but she can't see what's going on 5 feet behind her. Least likely to be invited to a sleepover in the Obama White House, Reverend Jerry Jackson, who was caught on an open mic talking about pitching Obama's voice an octave higher in A Matter of Speaking. Jackson was taking offense at Obama's suggestion that African Americans needed to take more responsibility for things like fatherhood and being responsible husbands, to which Jay Leno quipped, "Jesse thought it was insulting, not only to him, but to his former mistress and their love child." The best typo: in a story about potential vice presidential picks, the AP referred to Joe Lieberman as the Democratic vice presidential prick for 2000. Shortest fuse: John McCain's brother, Joe McCain, who called 911 to complain about being stuck in traffic. When the dispatcher asked if that was seriously why he was calling an emergency hotline, Joe the hothead cursed him out and hung up. We might have never known about the incident, except when the dispatcher called the cell phone back, he got this message: "Hi, this is Joe McCain. I can't take this message now because I'm involved in a very important family political project." And to think, he came within 8.5 million votes of becoming the next Roger Clinton. Worst exit strategy: John Edwards, who upon being confronted by a National Enquirer reporter at the Beverly Hills Hilton, after paying a late-night visit to his former mistress and her child, did what any self-respecting ex-senator and presidential aspirant with nothing to hide would do. He fled into a bathroom and tried to hold the door shut. Edwards later admitted to the affair, but he denied fathering her child. The best moment of Palin-Freud: the prank call Palin received from a Canadian comedy duo who convinced her she was talking to President Nicolas Sarkozy of France. Palin didn't pick up on any of the hints that the conversation was a joke, even when the faux Frenchman said, "From my house, I can see Belgium," or when he complimented her on the documentary about her life, Hustler's Nayland Palin. "Oh, good, thank you, yes," she replied. Worst attempt to woo the Fox News demographic: Barack Obama, who was heard at a San Francisco fundraiser saying that small-town voters are bitter and cling to guns or religion. The remark was so offensive to armed churchgoers, they didn't know whether to turn the other cheek or lock and load. Most notorious member of the Hypocrites VIP Club: former Governor Eliot Spitzer of New York, who rose to power as a sanctimonious crusader against ethics violations and corruption, but didn't let that get in the way of his taste for high-priced hookers. As Attorney General, Spitzer had famously busted prostitution rings, apparently so he could keep them all for himself. Spitzer was forced to resign after being outed as client number 9 at the Emperor's VIP Club. Jay Leno was confused. "He's the governor. Who were those 8 guys in front of him? You'd think as governor you'd at least get to go first." Worst con artist: Joe the plumber, who John McCain called his role model, even though it turned out he didn't have a plumber's license, was unemployed, had cheated on his taxes, and his name wasn't even Joe. As Jimmy Kimmel put it, he's the Sarah Palin of plumbing. Best reflexes: President Bush, who dodged 2 shoes hurled at him by an Iraqi journalist with a dexterity that conjured comparisons to Keanu Reeves in The Matrix. Although, as David Letterman noted, Too bad he didn't react that swiftly with bin Laden or Katrina, bin Laden or the mortgage crisis, bin Laden or Afghanistan, bin Laden or the Lehman Brothers. Most courageous act under imaginary fire, Hillary Clinton, whose account of dodging sniper fire after landing in Bosnia was debunked when video footage showed her being greeted on the tarmac, not by gunshots, but by a young girl's poetry reading, quipped Bill Mayer. If only she had channeled that active fantasy world into her marriage. Okay, we're running out of time. Most brutal Palin insult. It was humiliating enough when McCain aides called Palin a diva and a whack job, while accusing her of going rogue, throwing temper tantrums, and not knowing that Africa was a continent. But the most devastating soundbite came from a McCain aide who described her shopping spree as Wasilla Hillbillies looting Neiman Marcus from coast to coast. Best train wreck, the Sarah Palin-Katie Couric interview, which featured one laughable gaffe after another, including Palin's failure to think of any Supreme Court decisions other than Roe versus Wade, her failure to name a single newspaper or magazine she reads other than all of them, any of them, and her claim to foreign policy expertise because Vladimir Putin likes to rear his head and fly over Alaskan airspace. It teetered on such self-parody that all Tina Fey had to do on Saturday Night Live was repeat parts of Palin's answers verbatim. Gosh darn it. And also there you, and you betcha. Cheapest campaign stunt was John McCain, who suspended his campaign to go save the economy, said the presidential debate had to be canceled, flew to Washington, screwed up the bailout deal, then unsuspended his campaign and flew to the debate anyhow, even though there was no deal, quipped Bill Mayer. Usually when a 72-year-old man acts this way, this is when the kids start calling nursing homes. Okay, we're running out of time. I got a real good one I got to do. This is an article submitted by a 1999 Louisville Sentinel contest to find out who had the wildest Christmas dinner. As a joke, my brother Jay used to hang a pair of pantyhose over his fireplace before Christmas. He said all he wanted was for Santa to fill them. What they say about Santa checking the list twice must have been true, because every Christmas morning, although Jay's kid stockings overflowed, his poor pantyhose hung sadly empty. One year I decided to make his dream come true. I put on sunglasses and went in search of an inflatable love doll. They don't sell these things at Walmart. I had to go to an adult bookstore downtown. If you've never been to an X-rated store, don't go. You'll only confuse yourself. I was there nearly an hour saying things like, "What does this do?" "You're kidding me. Who'd buy that?" Finally, I made it to the inflatable doll section. I wanted to buy a standard, uncomplicated doll that could also substitute as a passenger in my truck so I could use the carpool lane during rush hour. Finding what I wanted was difficult. Love dolls came in so many different models. The top of the line, according to the side of the box, could do things I'd only seen in a book on animal husbandry. I settled for lovable Louise. She was at the bottom of the price scale. To call Louise a doll took a huge leap of imagination. On Christmas Eve, with the help of an old bicycle pump, Louise came to life. My sister-in-law was in on the plan and let me in during the wee morning hours. The next morning, my brother called to say that Santa had been to his house and left a present that made him very happy, but had left the dog confused. She would bark, start to walk away, then come back and bark some more. We all agreed that Louise should remain in her pantyhose so the rest of the family could admire her when they came over for the traditional Christmas dinner. My grandmother noticed Louise the moment she walked in the door. "What the hell is that?" she asked. My brother quickly explained, "It's a doll." "Who would play with something like that?" Granny snapped. I kept my mouth shut. "Where are her clothes?" Granny continued. "Boy, that turkey sure smells nice, Gran," Jay said to steer her into the dining room. But Granny was relentless. "Why doesn't she have any teeth?" Again, I could have answered, but why would I? It was Christmas, and no one wanted to ride in the back of the ambulance saying, "Hang on, Granny, hang on." My grandfather, a delightful old man with poor eyesight, sidled up to me and said, "Hey, who's the naked gal by the fireplace?" I told her she was Jay's friend. A few minutes later, I noticed Grandpa by the mantel talking to Louise. Not just talking, but actually flirting. It was then that we realized this might be Grandpa's last Christmas at home. The dinner went well. We made the usual small talk about who had died, who was dying, and who should be killed, when suddenly Louise made a noise like my father in the bathroom in the morning. Then she lurched from the mantel, flew around the room twice, and fell in a heap in front of the sofa. The cat screamed. I passed cranberry sauce through my nose, and Grandpa ran across the room, fell to his knees, and began administering mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. My brother fell back over his chair and wet his pants. Granny threw down her napkin, stomped out of the room, and sat in the car. It was indeed a Christmas to treasure and remember. Later, in my brother's garage, we conducted a thorough examination to decide the cause of Louise's collapse. We discovered that Louise had suffered from a hot ember to the back of her right thigh. Fortunately, thanks to a wonder drug called duct tape, we restored her to perfect health. I can't wait until next Christmas. And I'm sure after reading that, neither can you guys. Thanks very much for listening throughout the year, and I'll talk at you next week. Have a great New Year's Eve tonight, a safe New Year's Eve. Drive safely and consume drugs responsibly.